And just a little teaser here for our first feature on the show.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff. Ignition.
All right, liftoff, and the clock has started.
Yes, do you know who that was? Well, if you were listening to Matt and myself chatting a little while ago, you'll know that, but we'll tell you a bit later in the show. But first up, now, Ed Buckby was a co-author with the original, one of the original Mercury astronauts, Wally Schirra, and he's a co-author with Wally on the book The Real Space Cowboys, which has been published by Apogee Books. Now, Ed worked for NASA from 1959 when America's first Mercury astronauts were selected. There were seven of them selected. As I said, Wally Schirra was one of them. From 1961, Ed Buckby was at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, where he worked for Wernher von Braun. He met and worked with all of the astronauts who flew the early Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo missions. In 1970, he was selected by von Braun to be the first director of the United States Space and Rocket Center. He later founded the United States Space Camp and Aviation Challenge programs. He also teamed up with Wally Schirra and Alan Shepard in establishing the United States Astronaut Hall of Fame. Well, Ed Buckby visited Melbourne earlier this year. We were privileged to meet him and record his talk to the Space Association of Australia. And we're going to hear that talk now, or part of it now. And in this section, he's going to discuss the training of the Mercury astronauts. And a little, he peppered his talk with a whole lot of amusing anecdotes and things that we didn't know about the astronauts. So here we go with Ed Buckby.
My congratulations to you people for helping us keep that dream alive of traveling space. It's the only dream that I pay attention to anymore, is making sure we don't lose focus on the fact that this country, this world needs to continue to explore space for peaceful purposes. And I emphasize peaceful purposes because I never want to hear of an astronaut or a cosmonaut going into space with a sidearm. Let's hope that never happens in our lifetime. I want to give you a quick look at the early days of space travel. I'm not going to go into the shuttle program. This is basically Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. I dealt with the Mercury astronauts, which was an interesting experience, I might add, and I'll talk about that a little bit. And we picked those guys in those early years, Shepard and Schirra and Glenn. We found out real quickly that they knew nothing about rocks. Geology was something that they didn't think was actually to be concerned about because they were fighter pilots and test pilots. So what did we do? We took them out in the desert in New Mexico, and we basically gave them geology 101. And we're out there and in the middle of the desert, and in those days, NASA never did anything small. We had generators running in the background. We had portable dormitories, had suit technicians, the doctors, geologists, and in the middle of about 50 people in this circle were these two guys, suited up, completely suited up in moonwalking suits. We've been out there, and the second day, a tribe of Indians arrived. And the guy in charge of the test program said, "Buckby, today you are in charge of Indians." So I go out to engage and meet the young buck who's leading the tribe. Turns out that we are on the edge of their reservation, and he wanted to know what I was doing. And I said, "We are from the government," which was a mistake. Then I said, "We're also from NASA. And we're here, and we're training these two men to go to the moon," and pointed to the moon. He looked at me, and he looked at the astronauts and said, "We'd like to return tomorrow and bring our chief to meet the astronauts. Is that possible?" I said, "Yes, sir." Sure enough, the next morning, tribe's returning. Riding in front is a gentleman with full battle dress, carrying a spear, war paint, obviously the chief. They dismount. We introduce ourselves, take the chief over, introduce him to the two astronauts, have some pictures taken, and we're about to have them break up, and we were going to go about our testing. And just as we're about to break up, the chief reaches into a pouch and pulls out a cassette and hands it to one of the astronauts and said, through the young buck who was translating, "Would you take this to the moon?" And the astronaut said, "Yes, sir, we'd be happy to do that." They rode off into the sunset. We continued training. About 2 days later, we're back in Houston going through debriefing and unpacking, and somebody said, "Where's the chief's message?" We looked around, found it, found the machine, put it in, could not understand one word. It was in Navajo. So we sent the messenger out to find someone who could understand and speak Navajo, found the guy. He came in. He put the tape recorder in the machine, played it, and he burst out laughing. And we said, "What did the Indian chief say?" He said, "Dear moon people, beware of white man. That SOB will steal your land." True story. This is Shepard on the left and Shirai on the right. I'm in the middle. And we basically worked together from the day they became astronauts until they retired. The great thing about those two guys, they helped me create Space Camp. They believed in it. They contributed to it. And they made it work, both in Huntsville and in Florida. So I had a lot of contact with them over the years. And we actually invented the thing, the Real Space Cowboys. And they loved it. We used it frequently. And today, I still have some buddies that are in that category. But those are the two guys that really got us off the ground. We wrote this book called The Real Space Cowboys, which most of it is true. My part certainly is true. I can't always be sure about what their stories are, but it was basically the story of the early days of the Mercury astronauts. And in my career, I basically touched every one of those missions you see on that chart. There were actually 32 missions, about 44 astronauts from 1961 through 1975. I was either involved at the Cape, in Houston, Huntsville, either in the press area or welcoming them as they came back from their mission at our museum. So I had an interesting experience with Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts.
That's Ed Buckby, and we have more from Ed coming up shortly. But let's just hear a little bit of music now from the Kingston Trio. In 1963... they recorded this song called These Seven Men, and it's about the seven Mercury astronauts and their scouting of the new frontier of space. This song was written by Mike Stewart.
He's gone away for to stay a little while, but he's coming back if he goes 10,000 miles. Are these seven men whose path leads them so far and shake our minds to wonder who they are? They scout the new frontier to find the surest way, and they look to us, for they have shown the way. They're gone away for to stay a little while, but they're coming back if they go 10,000 miles. What is there left to look to that yet has not been done? What west is there if all the wests are won? Look not back o'er your shoulder, but high above your head, these seven men have shown the way. seven men have said, we're gone away for to stay a little while, but we're coming back if we go 10,000 miles. We're gone away.
In this next part of the talk, Ed Buckby discussed the early days of the space race, as it was known then. But he made one little error in his talk. Before Alan Shepard flew in space, a chimpanzee was sent up on an almost identical mission. That chimpanzee was known as Ham. Now, Ed refers to this as being Enos. Now, Enos, in fact, preceded John Glenn into orbit. Now, Shepard, I point out, did a suborbital flight, that is, up and then down, whereas John Glenn, in 1962, went into orbit, as had Yuri Gagarin in April of 1961. So Ham did the suborbital flight. Enos did the orbital flight. Here we go, back with Ed Buckby.
I don't have to remind you folks that this was a shocker this day. The Russians launched Sputnik. And that got a lot of attention all over the world. We thought that the Russians were really good tractor drivers, great farmers, but had no technology capabilities. Turns out we were badly mistaken, but it did engage our people. And I remember my professors telling me, you guys need to start studying engineering. This country's going to need engineers. And it did. It caused a whole development in the education process. We finally got that old Redstone that we had developed in Huntsville, Alabama as a missile, and we took the warhead off and put a satellite on. And that's Explorer 1. And that the day that was launched was the day that the space race began between Russia and the U.S. Well, guess what? 1959, President Eisenhower decided we need astronauts. Who do you think volunteered? Three Air Force, three Navy, and one Marine. Why? Because they wanted to go higher, faster, and farther. And to do that, you had to be an astronaut. Guys and gals, you are looking at the most interesting seven people I've ever encountered. They have a lot of swagger. You're talking egos beyond imagination. And if you ask them who's the best, every one of them will tell you, I'm the best. And in fact, when their boss brought them in for their first meeting, he asked them to write down the name of the first astronaut in this family who should fly in space. Who do you think they wrote down? Every one of them wrote their name, their own name down. So you get an idea of the kind of people that we're dealing with. They are looking for a challenge. And the best opportunity was to fly on a NASA rocket. We took them to Washington, and I think this was the first time they ever had a coat and tie on in their life. And the press went crazy. They're standing up on the tables. They're leaning over chairs. They're crawling around on the floor, and they're asking questions like, do you think you'll get back from space alive? That seemed to be the most interesting question of all from the press. Because they thought these guys were just going to jump on these rockets, we would blow them up, and they would, of course, pass away. So that was a coming out party for the Mercury family. We worked on this forever. We wanted a family portrait. And they hated these pictures because, as Shepard said, in those days we only had one suit, and we took turns wearing that suit. Well, there's one good suit, and the one on the left, that's Wally. He owned the suit, so he had the best suit on. The other six are rejects. The zippers don't work. The hoses are falling down in the back. In fact, John and the two guys in the middle have got combat boots on that we sprayed with silver paint. Would you believe this picture made the cover of Life magazine, Look magazine, all over Europe magazine covers. It turned out to be, you know, the family portrait of the Mercury 7. In fact, it's on the cover of my book, and it shows up all the time. So when you see that, you'll appreciate the effort that went in to make that picture, because they hated that picture to this day, especially after the movie The Right Stuff came out, because they used the same picture, and that even made them more disbelieving of what took place in the movie Right Stuff. The amount of testing these guys went through to be qualified at the Lovelace Clinic, and by the way, they hated that place. Are you familiar with the Lovelace Clinic? That was the place where they went in. They were not only examined, as John Glenn said, they found openings in my body that I did not know I had. So right here, this doctor, and they call them the doctors, they call them the medical cult. That medical cult doctor has just poured hot water in one of John's ears. He's now pouring cold water in the other ear for the purpose of seeing whether that has any effect on his eyeball movement. Now, we haven't figured out what that has to do with space travel, but that's the type of test these poor guys went through in those early years. And for some reason, they love to vibrate their bodies. And they went through all sorts of crazy vibrations, being dropped from high altitudes and made on things like special harness, ejection seats, again, trying to determine whether they could survive. So they went through that. And by the way, after the Mercury astronauts were tested, we never sent another astronaut to the Lovelace Clinic, because these seven guys said, you're not going to expect other people to go through this like what we've done through. So that was stopped. This was a very important machine in those days. They called it the wheel. It's really a centrifuge. You all know what a centrifuge is. Well, these fellas went through this machine on a monthly basis. You know how many G's they took? 16, ladies and gentlemen. That's 16 times your normal weight. Not necessarily because they would get it in a rocket ride, but if they had to hit the chicken switch, which is the ejection system, for a brief moment coming off that rocket with an escape tower, they would get about 16 G's. So they had to be acclimated to that, and that's why that machine was used. They went through all sorts of training in the desert, jungle. They ended up very soon in Huntsville, Alabama. Why do you think they came there? You see that guy on the right? That's Wernher von Braun. They came to meet the Rocket Man, because the Rocket Man was designing their ride to the moon. And that it was a custom for a fighter pilot and a test pilot to become very knowledgeable of the guy who was developing their aircraft. They wanted to get close to that person. And so they met von Braun. They loved his attitude. They loved the challenge that he accepted. And once they talked to him, they realized, hey, we're going to go to the moon. This guy's really going to make it happen. So it was a confidence builder to hang out with people like that. And we tested those rockets in those days, and we still do. Ground testing is what we did. We didn't launch anything, but we tested the vehicle on the ground. And we before we shipped to the Cape, it always went through a ground test. Shepard came in and watched several of those, and he came up to von Braun after one of them and said, I want to stand up on the tower next to that spacecraft while you're firing the engine. And Wernher said, well, Alan, why do you want to do that? He said, I want to see if I can read the instruments and reach the control handle. Test pilot attitude, mentality was flowing strongly. Von Braun said, no, it's too dangerous. I'm not going to let you do that. Guess what? He got two engineers to volunteer to do that. And sure enough, they stood up next to the spacecraft, looked in the window while it was being fired, and they could see the instruments and reach the control panel. So, again, it was a shocking surprise to the astronauts that they were actually not going to control the Mercury machine, that they were actually going to ride. And there, so there was always a fight between the engineers and the astronauts about the amount of control that they had, especially in the early days. Engineers said, we don't trust those astronauts. We want that machine to go based on the way we operate. It eventually changed, but in the early days, the astronauts had very little control of the spacecraft. Monkeys, primates, chimpanzees. I tell you what, I've never heard an astronaut have any kind words for a monkey. And the reason for that, these monkeys got all the rides in the early years. They showed up on the cover of Life magazine. They were the test articles, and the doctors loved them. because, you know, the monkey would go away and fly, come back, they put him in the cage and have to forget about it. So it was an interesting experience to watch the astronauts see these monkeys get all the attention. And one day, just before Shepard was to fly, they had just flown Enos on this flight. And the doctors were so excited about Enos's accomplishments, so they were getting ready to have a press conference. So Shepard said, Sherrod and Shepard were talking about it, and Sherrod said, Shepard, you're going to be going flying. You're going to be doing this next. So you need to go over, and we need to stand in the press room and hear what goes on, find out what kind of questions they ask. And sure enough, they put on their Bebop glasses, fighter pilot glasses, and a cap, went over and stood back in the back of the press room. And they brought Enos out, and the doctors read off all the accomplishments that Enos had made on that flight. And just as they turn on the lights and the cameras, Enos reaches down, rips off his diaper, and exposes himself. And Sherrod says to Shepard, you're next.
And we're listening there to the anecdotes of Ed Buckby. And, if you can get a hold of that book of his, it's a decent read. It's called The Real Space Cowboys, and it's published by Apogee Books. Well, this is the 55th anniversary of that first manned space flight by an American, and we'll have details about that after this message.
Hi, this is Kate Sobrano with a tip about oil and water. They don't mix. So please don't pour cooking oil or fat down the sink. It's just not the place for it. Instead, put your used oil in a container and throw it out with the rubbish. Remember, anything that goes down a drain that isn't water is a pollutant. So think before you pour. The future of water is in our hands. Yes, we never should know better.
This is the Space Show on Southern FM. And tomorrow is the 55th anniversary of America's first manned spaceflight. It was made by Commander Alan Shepard, and we have the details about that here. This is how the Americans covered the flight at the time.
This is Walter Cronkite at CBS-TV News, Project Mercury headquarters on Cape Canaveral. The Redstone rocket is ready. The Mercury capsule is ready. Commander Alan Shepard, our astronaut, is ready. The weather is good, and it is 10 minutes to launch time. The Redstone stands there with Shepard in the Mercury capsule atop it. The weather has cleared considerably after earlier problems with it, but now everything is in readiness, and it is T-9 minutes before this first attempt to put a man into space by the United States is scheduled to blast off. Shepard has been in the capsule for some time now, waiting for this takeoff. The helicopters are about to take off to go out to stand by just off the coast here at Cape Canaveral in case there should be an emergency procedure whereby Commander Shepard should find he must jettison from the rocket on takeoff. Downrange, seven ships of the United States Navy, numerous aircraft are standing by, waiting for Shepard to come plummeting out of the sky some 16 minutes after his takeoff from here. He has been in his capsule for some 4 hours now, waiting for this takeoff. It has been delayed by numerous small problems, some technical and some weather. This is America's effort after 2.5 years of preparation, 2.5 years since the go-ahead was given to Project Mercury. Alan Shepard, 37 years old, waits in that Mercury capsule you see right beside the cabin of the tall crane, which is called a cherry picker. That cabin is there to give Shepard egress should he find it necessary to leave. At the forward pad area is our correspondent Richard Bate. Come in, Dick.
Standing on the launching pad here at Cape Canaveral, the 83-foot tall Mercury Redstone rocket with astronaut Alan Shepard aboard. He's been there several hours now, up on top of the rocket in the escape capsule, ready to make a rocket ride some 15 minutes in length down the testing range here. Standing right beside the capsule is an escape crane. plane that he can duck into. The liquid oxygen vapor still streaming out the side of the rocket. As it stands here in the morning sunshine, the end product of work and hope for some 10,000 people. America's first manned rocket shot.
3 minutes, not counting.
The count has just been resumed, so we have a little over 2 minutes now to go. Over at the rocket, you see the bleed off of liquid oxygen vapor. That is the topping off process with the last bit of liquid oxygen, one of the mixtures for the high-powered fuel that will power the 78,000-pound thrust Rocketdyne engine and send this Redstone rocket into space. It is 2 minutes and counting, 120 seconds left before this blast off. There goes the cherry picker crane, which gave Shepard egress from his capsule in case it was decided that he must leave it without using the escape procedure. That tower that looks like a TV antenna on top of the capsule contains rockets which can blow the capsule away from the rocket itself if that should be necessary at any point as an escape procedure. And now, as this last minute begins, what is happening there is the controller in the blockhouse is announcing water flow to full, 35,000 gallons a minute pouring over the flame bucket where the flame from the 78,000-pound thrust engine will go. Then he announces range ready lights on, and with T-minus 1 minute, and that process has now begun. At T-minus 35, you'll hear the conductor pushing the button on the console. Automatic sequencer takes over. As this ship blasts off, we will be able to watch it for about 3 minutes, we expect. Then you will hear the voice of Colonel John Powers, information officer here, as he monitors the communication from the capsule itself.
T-minus 15 seconds. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition.
From control, we may be able to see at this great distance the separation of the capsule.
And 7 in voice communication with the Mercury Control Center. Reports 3.5 G. Cabin pressure holding fine. Cabin pressure holding 5.5 pounds per square inch.
That is communication from Shepard in the capsule being relayed to us by Colonel Power. Shepard is all right. He survived the strenuous G effort of the takeoff. He is reporting back by communication.
The trajectory is still A-OK. The pilot is in good voice communication with Mercury Control.
That was now, it is now about 2.5 minutes, and although we cannot...
7, with astronaut Alan B. Shepard reports the fuel system is go. 4G, cabin 5.5 pounds per square inch, oxygen go, all systems go.
We should be hearing that the capsule is separated from the rocket in a moment. For astronaut Alan Shepard
reports power jettison. Astronaut A-OK. Periscope coming out.
We'll continue to listen to these reports, but let's take a look meanwhile as we listen to the reports and as the rocket is out of our...
Turnaround started.
For astronauts and Alan Shepard, this historic flight is the sum total of 2 years of extensive training, climaxed early this morning when he arrived at the launch pad.
No movement now. Switching to manual control of the pitch attitude. Trajectory looks A-OK.
That is Shepard, seen earlier this morning at the energy capsule.
Switching to manual yaw.
The voice you hear is Colonel Power. He says that Shepard has just reported he's switching to manual yaw. That means
medical monitor and mercury control reports pilot's condition appears to be excellent.
And that's the best report we've had yet.
He's taking over manual control of the roll attitude.
This means that Shepard is actually controlling this craft now, something that the Russian astronaut Yuri Gagarin never did with his, as far as we know.
Okay.
retro rockets. He is positioning his capsule.
What a beautiful view is a quote.
Shepard has reported back, what a beautiful view. This is the scene of newsmen here at Canaveral. They have nothing to watch now, but can only wait for these reports.
3 to 4 tenths cloud cover along the eastern coast of the United States, obscuring the eastern coast up to Cape Hatteras.
Everything is going exactly according to plan, including these observations that Shepard can make from his capsule through the periscope that he has now extended from the capsule. He is controlling the flight.
That reports assuming retro attitude, initiating retro fire sequence.
The retro fire sequence.
Pilot reports mission very smooth.
Retro fire position will put the capsule back into position for landing. In a very short mounted landing, actually, but at the apogee of the 115-mile climb. It is at this
retro
point,
rocket number one has fired.
Where we can expect him shortly to report his condition of
retro number two has fired. Retro number three has fired.
With these operations, Shepard is now in a sitting position in his capsule. He's down his back for 4 hours waiting for takeoff. He got into that capsule
during the jettison, the retro rocket pod.
Got into that capsule at 5:15.
We are still receiving excellent voice communication from the pilot.
We were warned earlier at this excellent
medical monitor reports everything A-OK in the cockpit.
This excellent voice communication will not last throughout the flight. There will be a point where he switches over his main communication to the downrange station. At that time, we will have a secondary relay before we get it here. The excellent condition of the communication should continue, however, for Shepard with the downrange station.
The retro rocket packet has jettisoned. The retro rocket packet has been jettisoned.
The jettisoning of the retro rocket packet means that the capsule is about to go back into its ballistic flight, uncontrolled by Shepard.
The mission is now 6 minutes and 40 seconds old. Astronaut Alan V. Shepard is still talking to us, working like a test pilot, reporting facts and figures, reporting procedures in the precise engineering manner of a test pilot.
This great radar antennas here at the Cape are picking up this communication with Shepard as he hurtles through the air at 4,500 miles an hour toward his 115.
Getting to roll into re-entry attitude.
He has passed his 115-mile-an-hour apogee, beginning
automatic
to...
Automatic control system operating properly.
Getting back to his landing position in a rubber sheet.
The craft is beginning to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. We have a registration in the control center indicating 0.05 of a G, indicating the beginning of penetration.
0.05 of a G, that means that bare gravity is beginning to take over again on Alan Shepard. He has been weightless.
We are still in voice communication with the pilot.
He's hurtling down into the atmosphere.
9G coming down.
And this is the most dangerous part of the operation, perhaps the re-entry, if the capsule is not in exact position.
His words are okay.
There could be problems here.
Going to peak G now. He is still talking, saying okay.
A moment ago, he was experiencing weightlessness. Now, as he will...
All data here at the Mercury Control Center at this time is excellent.
We expect to hear shortly that the parachutes have opened and that he is descending gradually to the ocean again. At that point, he will encounter G-force of 11 Gs, as expected, which will make him weigh, in effect, some 1,760 pounds. From weightlessness to 1,760 pounds in a matter of a few seconds, comparatively.
Pilot reports 30,000 feet on the way down.
That's the point at which his small parachute is scheduled to open. There's a small parachute which steadies the craft, and then the large 63-foot...
Pilot now talking to us via a link, radio link, at Grand Bahama Island, and we're leading him loud and clear.
That was where we thought that here at the Cape...
The drogue parachute has deployed. The drogue parachute has deployed.
That's the drogue parachute. That's the small one, and it means that undoubtedly this mission is going to be successful. The recovery of the pilot is still a problem, of course. The big parachute has to open, but the main factors have been licked.
Pilot reports all systems in the cockpit A-OK and operating properly. So medical monitor in the Mercury Control Center reports the pilot A-OK all the way. The main parachute has deployed. The main
parachute is open, and the space flight is a success. Recovery of the pilot is yet to come, but the control is there.
And that recovery took some time. And here's how that recovery was reported.
Here at Cape Canaveral, just 4 minutes ago, the announcement came over the public address system, test 108 is terminated. Rather cold words, four of them, that spelled the end to one of our greatest successes in space, a success that went with 100% perfection, it appears, in every sense of the word. As a matter of fact, no one here had really anticipated that the entire operation would take but 25.5 minutes. The flight itself, 16 minutes. The recovery, less than 10 minutes from the time Alan Shepard landed his spacecraft in the waters of the Atlantic, exactly on target 290 miles from Cape Canaveral, until he was lifted onto the deck of the carrier by helicopter. And as you heard, he is in excellent shape, apparently. He seems to be, of course, delighted with what has transpired here this morning. And, of course, at Cape Canaveral, there is nothing but excitement and happiness now. And if there is happiness here, it must be reflected a thousandfold in two homes elsewhere in the country, at Virginia Beach, Virginia, where Mrs. Shepard, the two Shepard children, girls 9 and 13, and the niece who has lived with them most of their lives, who is also 10 years old, they listened and heard this report that their father and husband had become America's first spaceman. And also, Alan Shepard's father, Alan Shepard himself, this is Alan Shepard Jr., the astronaut. Well, Alan Shepard and Mrs. Shepard heard the news in Derry, New Hampshire, where their flag bedecked home is now the scene, we presume, of congratulations from all of their neighbors who also were anxiously waiting the returns from this flight. Here at Cape Canaveral, the question now is simply one of waiting for further reports from downrange. Cape Canaveral's part in this operation ended with the last telemetry report, and as you heard a moment ago, test 108 is terminated. Test 108 being the Mercury Redstone launch of our first man into space. The Lake Champlain will turn and steam toward the Grand Bahama Islands, but Shepard will take off from its deck shortly. We do not know exactly how long, and go on down to the Grand Bahama Islands, where his own doctors, the astronaut doctors, Dr. Douglas, Dr. Jackson, will be waiting. They took off from Cape Canaveral here just a couple of moments ago, as soon as they were sure that he had landed safely downrange.
And we're going to hear more about this flight after this message.
Hey, we're Axco!
Woo! And you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
And the Space Show. Now, we're going to return to Ed Buckby, who has some comments about this particular flight, which was officially called Mercury Redstone 3, MR3.
Take long, May 5, 1961. We got Shepard ready. He climbed in a spacecraft, and it was my first rocket or missile ever to see flown, May 5, 1961, and we had liftoff. And ladies and gentlemen, that was the beginning of manned space flight for the United States of America. And it continues today to be our business in flying humans in space. With only that short flight around, this young president, Jack Kennedy, became excited about the space program. And he called him to the White House.
I want to again express my congratulations to Alan Shepard. We're very proud of him. And I speak on behalf of the Vice President, who is chairman of our Space Council and who bears great responsibilities in this field, the members of the House and Senate Space Committee who are with us today, and this decoration, which has gone from the ground up. Yeah.
That was a big day for the families, for Kennedy and all of us. And with only 15 minutes of space flight under our belt, this young president committed the country to this.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept.
Thank you.
And we're going to end this celebration of the 55th anniversary since that first American manned spaceflight with a musical item by Counting Crows, and it's simply called Mercury.
Trapped inside a month of gray, and they take a little every day. She is a victim of her own responses, shackled to a heart that wants to settle and then runs away. It's a sin to be feeding endlessly. Leaving on a walk away. She is leaving me in disarray. In the absence of a place to be, she stands there looking back at me, hesitates and then turns away. She'll change so suddenly. She's just like Mercury. Yeah, she's alright with me. Sorrow in your hearts and minds for the things that die before their time, for the restless and the abandoned homes, tired and weary ramblers, bones, and stay beside me where I lie. She's entwined in me, crazy as can. She's all right with me. She's all right with me. She's all right with me.